The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Kalayla Williams, and I'd like to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for tonight's reading. Author, publisher, broadcaster, and philanthropist, tonight we will hear from Tavis Smiley, who has become a household name for his advocacy and change-making. He has hosted acclaimed programs on BET, NPR, and PBS, including his currently running Tavis Smiley on PBS and Tavis Talks on Blog Talk Radio. His nonprofit organization, the Tavis Smiley Foundation, has inspired a new generation of American leaders and recently began a $3 million campaign focused on ending poverty. His communications company, the Smiley Group, has the mission of empowerment, encouragement, and enlightenment. Smiley has garnered numerous awards and honorary doctorate degrees, including the notable Du Bois Medal from Harvard University. Time magazine named him as one of the world's most 100 influential people. He has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and he even recently appeared on Dancing with the Stars. Smiley is the best-selling author of 16 books, including Fail Up, The Covenant with Black America, and The Rich and the Rest of Us, which he co-authored with Cornel West. Called An Eloquent Emotional Journey by Kirkus Reviews, his newest book is Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. With candidness and forthright prose, the book recounts the little-known story of King's last 365 days, in which he faced disparagement and attempted undermining from many sides. The president, the FBI, other African-American leadership, the nation's black elite, and frustrated youth. He endured scalding criticism of his character, ideology, and political strategies, all of which he had to overcome so that all of us someday will. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the author of Death of a King, Tavis Smiley.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was whispering to Kalayla that that was perhaps the second best introduction I've ever received. And I only say second best because I was in Atlanta the other day, and the person to introduce me didn't show up, and I did it myself. So other than that, it was awfully nice. I thank you. Great to be back in Philadelphia again, the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. Always love coming back to this great city. And I don't know why y'all show up every time I come, but thank you for showing up. I appreciate it and anxious to get into this conversation tonight about this book regarding the person that I regard, as the book's introduction will suggest, or certainly the book's dedication will suggest, the person I regard as America's greatest democratic, small d, America's greatest democratic public intellectual. That's how I regard Dr. King, as our greatest democratic public intellectual. Before I do that, I just want to get this out of the way right quick. Any Dancing with the Stars fans in the house? Anybody? All right, so I got a treat for you. Pull out your phones right quick. Pull out your phones. Pull your phones out. You're not going to want to miss this, so I don't want you to be mad at me that I didn't tell you to pull your phones out. So I brought a surprise for you tonight, Philadelphia. Part of what I have to do make this Dance with the Stars thing work is to rehearse 4 to 6 hours a day. In the midst of being on a book tour and running back to L.A. to do my TV show and my radio show, every day I've got to carve out 4 to 6 hours for rehearsal. Don't ask me how I'm doing it. I don't know. Sometimes it's at midnight. Sometimes it's at 5 in the morning, for example. What was today? Where am I? Philly? This is Philly, right? You know, today's Thursday. So we danced on Monday night, and the results show was on Tuesday night. We made it through. We were safe. Isn't that good? Made it through the first week. So the results show was on Tuesday night. The minute the show was over, literally we ran straight to the airport to catch a flight to Atlanta, flew all night to Atlanta, got in at 6:30, and they had me rehearsing at 8 a.m. I landed at 6:30. I had my dancing shoes on at 8 for like 4 hours, and then I started doing book stuff the rest of the day. So today, was one of those days where we worked all morning. I think I've done every media outlet in this city today. And very nice piece in the Inquirer today. So somebody tell them, I said, thank you for the piece in the Inquirer today. Thank you. Whoever, yeah, appreciate that. So I've been doing every media outlet in the city, and I literally just ran in here late because I just took off my dancing shoes. I'm a 3 or 4 hour rehearsal today. So I thought I would bring a friend along with me that you might want to see. So please welcome one of a former semifinalist on Dancing with the Stars, my partner, Shauna Burgess. Yeah, Shauna. So this is Shauna, and this is the person that makes me rehearse hours every day. So we have to, the competition next Monday is the next round, and so we're literally, everybody else who's competing is like in L.A. right now, and they've got all the time in the world to rehearse, and we got to squeeze it in on the road. She just had me in the hallway back there, literally.
Yeah.
In a hallway.
Didn't work very well, yeah. But we tried.
In a hallway rehearsing just a moment ago, and so I thought I would let Shauna come out and say hello to Philadelphia.
Hey, Philadelphia! Yeah. This is my second time here in this city, and I love it already so much. And the great part about this guy being so busy is I get to walk around and explore. but I am obviously very excited to be here, and this is such a wonderful man, and I'm getting to know that more and more every day. So I'm excited for you guys to be able to sit here and hear what he has to say. But the most important thing I want to say to you is please vote for us. Make sure you tune in on Monday night. We are doing the cha-cha this week, and he is really killing it. He's doing so good. We can't tell you what song, but
give me a hint.
Should we do the hint? Should we do the little hint? The hint is the elements. Some people got it. Some people got it. It's My Jam Monday. So this is a song that Tavis has chosen to dance to. And I'm telling you, he picked a good one. So if you think you saw a different side of him last week, make sure you tune in this week because it is wilding out and crazy this time. It's going to be a lot of fun. But thank you for having me here. Mwah, love you guys. And enjoy this wonderful man.
So you want to see a quick step right quick? You didn't act like you really wanted to hear it. You want to see a quick step? You want to see? Okay. So we'll do just a teeny weeny bit. This is a Philadelphia exclusive, y'all. She's not come out. She stays in the hotel all day until it's time for rehearsal. So I was able to get her out tonight. So this is an exclusive for the city of Philadelphia. All right.
All right. Ready? Let's go this way. Not too close to the edge. Ready? Right. 1, 2, 3. Tell the world.
Now I can really use this. Anyway, I've been asked 1,000 times, why Dance with the Stars, Tavis? Because just a week or so ago, I turned 50. And I decided that before I turned 50, I'd do one last foolish thing. And it's either Dance with the Stars or climbing Mount Everest. So I'm not sure I made the right decision. Mount Everest might have been easier than these rehearsals every day. But anyway, I'm glad that Shauna is in town, and so we leave here in a few hours. Next stop is Memphis, and I had to rehearse tomorrow. Next stop, Birmingham, got to rehearse Saturday, and then back to L.A. On Sunday for the show on Monday. So anyway, for those who like the show, I thought you'd appreciate having Shauna come out. So there you go. There you go. All right. Now to the business of the hour. Let me start by thanking the Free Library once again for having me here. I am always, always honored and humbled to be in what I consider sacred space, and I mean that sincerely. So many great American writers, so many iconoclastic journalists and others have graced this stage, and so I always count it a privilege to be invited back to this stage, and as I said earlier, always pleased that so many of you show up for these conversations. This is book number 17 for me, but who's counting? Book number 17, and I have some good news to report. The book just came out a few days ago, and of all the books I've written, 17 to be exact, I've never had the experience that I had the other day of my publisher calling me to let me know that the day the book went on sale, they went into a second print the day the book came out. So the book apparently is doing well, and I guess Little Brown is happy, so if they're happy, I'm happy. And I hope you'll be happy when you get a chance to read the book. And if not happy, certainly I hope that you will be enlightened and empowered and maybe even encouraged by the example that you are going to read of Martin's courage and conviction and commitment, most especially in the last year of his life. Let me jump right in because I want to say, take my watch off here. I want to say some good time for your Q&A at the end, and then we'll sign your books here, lock the door, make you buy the book. And then we'll sign some copies. Let me answer the question I get asked so often, which is a pretty basic and obvious question, I suspect. Why another book about Dr. King? I'm sure somebody was thinking that. Why another book about Dr. King? Because this story about King has not been told in the way that we tell it. There has never been a book until this one that focuses exclusively and specifically on the last year of his life, literally the last 12 months, the last 52 weeks, the last 365 days. Never a book that focused just on that last year. Why is that year so important? Because on April 4, 1967, Dr. King goes to New York City, into Manhattan at the Riverside Church, and gives the most controversial speech of his entire life. The speech, as you know, was called Beyond Vietnam. And in that speech, Dr. King came out and called America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. He went on in that speech to say it's time to break the silence. That silence on this particular issue, said King, is betrayal. There comes a time when silence is betrayal, and my conscience leaves me no other choice. And so I come to this place tonight. He said that, and then later in that talk, he raised the issue that he talked about so frequently in the last year of his life. This notion of what he called the triple threat facing America. What is that triple threat? Racism, poverty, and militarism. Racism, poverty, and militarism. And so Martin gives this speech on April 4, 1967. A year to the day later, April 4, 1968, he is murdered in Memphis. And so there's been so much talk over the years about this last year. And folk have had a field day, certainly conspiracy theorists have had a field day with what does it mean that he gives this speech on April 4, 67, and he's murdered April 4, 68. Whatever one thinks of the coincidence of those dates, one has to look at the journey that Martin had to navigate, the terrain that he had to traverse in the last year of his life, if you really want to come to understand him. Why is this last year so critical? Glad you asked. Because it seems to me that we don't really get to know who we really are. You don't know who you really are, and I don't know who I really am until we have to navigate the darkest and most difficult days of our lives. Somebody say amen? Amen. It's in those dark and difficult periods that we really come to understand who we really are. Can I keep it real? Not just who we are, but who's with us. Mm-hmm. In the dark and difficult moments, you get to know more about yourself. And you learn about the persons who say that they are ride or die, that they're with you to the end. That's when you learn who you are and who the folk around you ultimately are. And so if you think you know Dr. King, but you don't know about the last year of his life, then you really don't know Dr. King. I think a lot of Americans think, nobody in this room, because you are far too smart for that, free library audience, nobody in this room, but some folk we know, I believe, think that Dr. King only gave one speech in his whole life. And then they think that speech only had one line in it. Shall we recite it together? I want my children to live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their... I ain't gonna ask you to go no farther. I know that's all you know. Because that's all they teach us. That's the only sound bite that we ever hear. That's the only clip that they ever play. And so many people think that Martin only gave one speech in his life, that it only had one line in it. That speech was given in August of 1963. The Negro lived another 5 years. He's not dead until 1968. So if you have, you see my point here, right? If you have frozen him in this frame of the March on Washington and I Have a Dream in August of 63, if that is your perspective of King, if that's the end all be all, if that's all that you know, then you don't know Martin. But the most difficult and the darkest days of his life came in that last 12 months from April 4 of 67 to April 4 of 1968. Now, let me just say this right quick, and I say this in every talk that I give, and especially and principally tonight, because when I walked in the back room, as I always do, and study the photos of the persons on the wall who have graced this room with their presence, I looked on the wall, and there was my friend Taylor Branch. So I want to make sure that I acknowledge to you, as I do in the book, in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, that King has three principal biographers, and I want to acknowledge them. Taylor Branch, David Garrow, and Claiborne Carson. Those are his three principal biographers, Branch, Garrow, and Carson. And without their work, I couldn't have written Death of a King. So they've done the heavy lifting as historians in really giving us the content of this rich history regarding this great American name, Martin King. They've given us the content. What I've tried to do in this text is to provide the context. They've given us the content, and I thank God for them. But this book provides the context of what Martin had to deal with. It is the only book that's ever been written that looks at the last year, as I said earlier. It's the only book about him written from his perspective. That is to say, it's written from his eyes, from his vantage point. We put you in the story with him. And you experience from page one to whatever the last page is, you experience what it's like to be in his space. Everything, the story is told in real time over that last 12 months. What he had to deal with every day over that last 12-month journey, you're with him in every one of those moments. When he's happy, when he's sad, when he's disappointed, when he's abandoned, when he's having a good time, when he's laughing, when he's perplexed, when he's depressed and despondent and can't get out of bed. Every experience he has, when he's confessing to his wife, his shortcomings, every experience that he has in this last year, you are with him every step of the way. So it's written from his vantage point. You're in his space. You're part of his inner circle. You'll notice on page one that we don't call him Dr. King. He's Doc. And don't let that throw you when you start reading. From page one to the last page of the book, he's Doc. Because everybody in his inner circle called him Doc. And I want to take him off that pedestal and humanize him for you and make him your friend, make him your confidant, put you in the space with him so you can feel what he felt, endure what he endured, and share in what he shared. So we put you in the story in real time with Doc from page one so you can walk this last mile of the way with Doc. So that's what makes this book uniquely different. Now, to the story itself. Dr. King goes to Riverside Church, as I said earlier, April 4, 67, and gives this speech. And the next day, everything and everybody in this country turned against him. I live in L.A., and you've all heard the adage that there is no such thing as an overnight success. There is no such thing as an overnight success. By the time you discover a particular actor at a certain stage in his career, chances are they've been on Broadway and waiting tables and, you know, regional theater, local theater. By the time you discover them, they've been at this for a long time. So there is no such thing, as we say in Hollywood, there's no such thing as an overnight success. And I've come to believe that. There is no such thing as an overnight success. Having said that, you can go from being a success to being a failure overnight. There are exhibits that we see in the news every day. Exhibit A, Ray Rice. Exhibit B, I can do this all night if I had the time. You don't go to being a success overnight, but you can certainly go from success the other direction pretty quickly. So Martin King is one of the most regarded men in America, one of the most admired Americans. He's a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, the youngest then and still the youngest to receive, to this day the youngest, to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And overnight, everything turns on him. Everybody and everything turns against him. I know Martin must have felt like the cosmos had shifted against him. Because the next day after giving that speech, the next day, April 5, 1967, every major news outlet in this country castigated him. And some, if I might say so, attempted to emasculate him. The next day, they turned on him. And I don't mean the conservative media. Fox News wasn't around then, so we ain't talking about Fox News. I'm talking about the liberal New York Times. When you read in this book what the New York Times said about Martin King the next day, it will embarrass you. When you read what the liberal Washington Post said the next day, the liberal Boston Globe, when you read what these papers said the very next day, you'll feel insulted. When you read what Time Magazine said about Dr. King that week, it'll make you cry. And all that's in the text. I want to give you a sense of how the media did a 180 on him the very next day. Every media outlet in this country turned on him sooner than right now and quicker than at once. That's how fast it happened, overnight. So the media turns on him first. And I don't mean just the mainstream media, the black media turned on him. I'm in Pennsylvania, is that right? I'm trying to remember where I am. You're going to read in this book what the black paper in Pittsburgh, the Courier, wait till you read what they wrote about Martin King that next day, that next week. And they were just one paper. There are so many examples I could have used. But the black press turned on him. So the media turns on him the very next morning. And then the White House turns on him. Now, you know that Martin, up until this point, has worked pretty closely with President Johnson. They passed the Voting Rights Act together. They passed the Civil Rights Act together. So he'd been working very closely with Lyndon Johnson. Until Martin comes out against the war that Johnson is fighting. And when he does that, Johnson wants no part of it. And King is disinvited to the White House. Johnson continues to meet with black leaders, but King ain't invited. So he's disinvited from the Johnson White House. So the media turns on him. The White House turns on him. And then white America turns on him. The last poll taken in his life, the Harris poll, found that 75%, nearly three quarters of the American people, thought he was irrelevant in the last year of his life. Three quarters of us thought he was irrelevant in the last year of his life. That's Americans writ large. Black folk, hold on to your seats. I mean it. Strap yourself down. In that same poll, we find that nearly 60% of black people thought he was irrelevant and persona non grata. His own people turned on him. And when I say his own people, I mean Roy Wilkins and the NAACP went after him. You know why? Because the Johnson White House did what White Houses do. When they get in trouble, they call their surrogates. And they remind you what they have done for you. And they call in their favors, as it were. And they told these Negroes, we passed the Voting Rights Act, Negroes. We passed the Civil Rights Act, Negroes. And now Martin is acting a fool, and y'all Negroes had better go check him. And that's exactly what these Negroes did. Roy Wilkins and the NAACP came out and dogged Dr. King publicly. Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate, was on the board of directors for the NAACP. And the NAACP authorized a resolution condemning Dr. King, which they released publicly. And before they released it, Ralph Bunche got a copy of it, and he didn't think the condemnation was strong enough, and he toughened it up. Ralph Bunche and the NAACP. Whitney Young and the Urban League, they got some too. They wrote an editorial, castigated Dr. King publicly. So the NAACP is on him. Now keep in mind now, these are Negroes he's just worked with for years. They turned overnight on Dr. King. So Roy Wilkins and the ACP comes after him. Whitney Young and the Urban League comes after him. Ralph Bunche comes after him. Adam Clayton Powell Jr., hater. Straight hater. He hated on Dr. King so vicious. I mean, I don't even want to recall what Congressman Powell did and said to Dr. King publicly. Just lied on him and demonized him to the press vicious, just vicious with it. So I can't even want to recall what he did to King. And I would not dare quote, looking at this audience tonight, out of respect for you, you'll see it in the text so you can read it on your own terms, but I would not stand here tonight and quote for you what is in the book. I won't quote what Thurgood Marshall said about Dr. King. It's going to break your heart. Thurgood Marshall couldn't stand Martin King. Couldn't stand him. Called him a boy on a man's errand. That's Thurgood Marshall in the last year of King's life. A boy on a man's errand. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. They turned on Martin in a vicious way. Carl Rowan, the leading black journalist of his era, wrote a piece in Reader's Digest that was scathing about Dr. King. So the media's turned on him. The White House has turned on him. White folk have turned on him. Black folk have turned on him. And inside his own organization, SCLC, he calls his own team, these are his words, a team of wild horses. That's how he described his team, Jesse and Andy and Ralph and all of them, a team of wild horses. In the last year of his life, his own organization that he founded passed a resolution condemning him on the Vietnam issue. His own organization, his own board of trustees. Resolution condemning Martin. And as he works aggressively on the Poor People's Campaign that he's trying to get off the ground in that last year, his team won't even support him on the Poor People's Campaign. They didn't want him to speak out against Vietnam and wouldn't support him on his Poor People's Campaign. So the media, the White House, white folk, black folk, his own organization. Martin doesn't even know that his treasurer in the organization, his own treasurer, he's talking to him, traveling with him every day. His treasurer is a paid FBI informant. His personal photographer is a paid FBI informant. And they are reporting back to Hoover every day on what's happening on the inside. So he's catching hell on the inside, catching hell on the outside, getting death threats every day. He can feel the death angel hovering over him. He's trying to tell folk he knows there's a bullet out there with his name on it. He knows his time is limited and they don't want to hear it. His inner circle, because they don't want to imagine. They love Martin so much, they don't want to imagine Martin not being with them, so they don't want to hear that. Who in that moment, in that last year, who does Martin King turn to? So what kind of man has he become in this last year? How does he navigate his way through this last year? And what does it all mean for us in 2014 and beyond? And so Martin King, in the last year of his life, has everybody and everything, the strongest headwind, the worst kind of obstruction he's facing every single day. And yet he gets up every day determined to still tell the truth. Martin's a bad man. Got up every day still determined to tell the truth. In that last year, there were a number of times he was hospitalized for what they said was exhaustion. We now know that Martin King had mania. He was depressed. He was despondent. And who wouldn't be with all that hell and all that hate coming at you? There's a story in the book of one day he got up and got dressed, put his clothes on, put his suit on, put his socks and shoes on, and couldn't get out the door. Just couldn't get out the door. He got back into bed fully clothed and pulled the covers over his head and just cried and cried and cried until he fell asleep. There were days like that in the last year because everybody and everything had turned against him. So what I'm saying here is that we have so deified him in death that we haven't come to terms with how we demonized him in life. In a very real way, we helped to kill King because we abandoned him when he was trying to tell us the truth about our democracy being unstable and being in trouble. If we didn't address that triple threat of racism and poverty and militarism, we turned a deaf ear and a blind eye. We abandoned him. And in those pictures you see of Martin laying on that balcony in Memphis with blood everywhere, there are all kinds of folk in the photos, but you can rest assured that Martin died alone. The most depressing part of working on this book is to realize that Martin had no idea that all these years later, Holiday, Monument in Washington, postage stamp, schools, libraries, streets, books, movies, documentaries. I had no idea that a kid named Tavis, who wasn't even born yet, was going to one day write a book about him, trying to remind the world of what his legacy really was. His legacy is enduring. My life is about one simple thing. With all the work that I do, it's about one simple thing. Radio, television, this, that, and the other. It's all about one thing. Trying to do my small part to make the world safe for his legacy. I believe the very future of this democracy is inextricably linked with how seriously we take his legacy. And what is that legacy? Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. A love that liberates people. Consider this for a second. J. Edgar Hoover at one point had Martin King listed in the FBI, as you well know, as the most dangerous man in America. Y'all remember this? The most dangerous man. Y'all didn't hear that. Martin King, the most dangerous man in all of America. I don't know about you, but that says a couple things to me. The only weapon that Martin Luther King Jr. ever used was love. How can you be the most dangerous man in the world and the only weapon you use is love? I don't know about you, but that says to me that love must be the most powerful force in the world. Love must be the only thing that can turn an enemy into a friend. It must not be about the love of power, but rather about the power of love. Love must, whatever this love thing is, it must be pregnant with a whole lot of power. If that's the only weapon you're using, and they declare you the most dangerous man in America, what might happen then if we could ever find our way to really operationalize a true definition in this country, in our public policy, of love? And by love, all we mean is that everybody is worthy just because. I'll say that again. Love just means that everybody is worthy just because. Everybody's somebody's child. Everybody's somebody's kid. And we are all equally worthy just because. Not because of your last name. Not because of your annual income, not because of where you live, what kind of car you drive, where you went to school, how many degrees you have, who your mom and them are, who you know, what kind of access you have. That is all irrelevant. We are all equally worthy. All life is precious. All life has the same value just because. Now, if we could ever take that definition of love and operationalize it in our politics and implementize it in our politics, that would mean that everybody, since we're all worthy just because, then everybody ought to have access to high quality health care. Everybody ought to have access to an equal high quality education. If we're all worthy just because, everybody ought to have a job that doesn't pay a minimum wage but a living wage. If we're worth, y'all getting this? If we're all worthy just because that's Martin's definition. It changes fundamentally what this country can be. And that's what Martin believed. And so we might add one more weapon to his arsenal. Love over here and ideas over here. You got to be really insecure to be scared of an idea. I guess Victor Hugo was right. There's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. So Martin got love and ideas. Love and notions. And that makes you, Negro, the most powerful man, the most dangerous man, rather, in America. I want you to think about that beyond tonight. I can spend an hour talking just about that piece because it says so much about the power of love. That makes you the most dangerous man. I don't mean to proselytize, but I guess that's why they were scared of Jesus. They couldn't handle that love. That love was too deep. For those of us who are believers in that sense, and I don't mean to, again, proselytize, and if you're atheist or agnostic, I ain't mad at you. But for those of us who are believers, you know, They put him on a cross because he wanted to love. That's all he wanted to do, was spread love. And they killed him. They crucified him for loving folk, for healing folk, for helping folk, for feeding folk. I think that means that the more truth you tell and the harder you love people, the closer you're going to get to a cross. We sang a song in my little church growing up in Indiana. We sang a song that said, "Must Jesus bear the cross alone and all the world go free? No, there's a cross for everyone and there's a cross for me." Now, even if you're atheist or agnostic or something else, you understand the point. Every one of us in life has a cross we have to bear. Dr. King put it this way: life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? That's the most urgent question in life. What are you doing for others? I have come to believe in my short 50 years that we do not come into the fullness of our own humanity if we can't revel in the humanity of other people. If we can't see that everybody else is worthy just because, then we haven't even experienced the fullness, the wholeness of our own individual humanity. And so Martin King, just preaching a message of love, has the whole country turn on him. Let me close on this note. I told you how depressing it was to just consider that journey he walked all by himself. And there's stories I don't have time to get into tonight. There's a story about him being on a balcony on the ocean one night. Ralph Abernathy thought he had jumped and committed suicide, because, you know, and if you don't know, in the book you will read that when Dr. King was a 12-year-old boy, he tried to commit suicide. So he had a fatalistic complex to begin with. As a child, he thought he was responsible for the death of his grandmother, thought that he had killed his grandmother. She had a heart condition, but he thought he'd killed her. She died. He thought he had killed her. And he couldn't take it, went to the roof of the house, climbed up to the roof, and jumped off and tried to kill himself. As a 12-year-old kid, he loved his grandmother that much. So he was ready to die for this love thing at 12. But Martin King, in this last year, deals with all of this drama. He's under surveillance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, under surveillance and being wiretapped everywhere he goes. So I tell you the most depressing part in my research. Here's the part that gave me the most sublime joy. In all those hours and 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 hours of surveillance tape and audio tape and wiretapping, not one time, not one single solitary time do they ever hear Martin King on tape ever contesting the humanity of any other human being. Nothing derogatory, nothing derisive, nothing demeaning, nothing demonizing about nobody. That love ethic that he talked about, he lived that thing in public and in private. It was part of his DNA. That is not to suggest that he was a perfect servant. He was a public servant, not a perfect servant. And this book does not shy away from dealing with his shortcomings, faults, frailties, mistakes, miscalculations. It's all in there. But at the end of the day, that love thing he talked about was a part of his DNA. Now, I believe that the time for this book is now, because Martin King has been so sanitized and so sterilized and so romanticized and in some ways so demonized that the truth about him is going to one day be irrecoverable if we keep allowing the narrative that's already been spun to continue to be spun. Somebody's got to tell the truth about the complexity of who he was and really get the story out about the journey he had to walk again, that last mile of the way when everybody turned on him and he had to pray himself through and push himself through and keep telling his truth. That's the Martin that I love the most. Not the one of the Montgomery bus boycott, not the one of I Have a Dream, not the one of the Selma March, not the one of the Nobel Peace Prize. The Martin I love the most is the one who stood in his truth when everybody turned on him and abandoned him. Martin was always interested in seeking the truth and speaking the truth and standing on the truth and staying with the truth. It was always about truth for him. And he committed himself to being faithful unto death. Martin said, "I'd rather be dead than to be afraid. I'd rather be dead than to be afraid." I'm going to give you one last tidbit and we'll take your questions. Now, this is going to knock you out your chair. So please hold on real tight. Martin King was assassinated on a Thursday night in Memphis on that balcony at the Lorraine Motel. I'll be there tomorrow. Tomorrow night, I'm lecturing. It's a brand new, they've completely remodeled the, I mean, that room, that piece is still the same, of course, as a part of history. But the hotel has been a museum for quite some time. They've completely redone it, remodeled it, spent $170 million, whatever it was. It's a beautiful facility. I was there earlier this year as the host of the grand reopening ceremony for the public. And now I'm going back tomorrow on the occasion of this book to lecture and sign at the museum tomorrow, just steps away from where King was murdered. So tomorrow's going to be, y'all pray for me tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be a heavy day to take this book back to Memphis. But King was killed in Memphis on a Thursday night. Had he made it back to Atlanta on Sunday to Ebenezer to preach his Sunday morning sermon, and we know what he was going to preach because every Sunday, every Thursday or Friday, rather, he called in to his secretary to tell her what his sermon was going to be so they could get it typed up and into the Sunday bulletin. So when you came to church Sunday morning, they passed out the bulletin. Here's the order of services. Here's the sermon topic today. He called it in every week. One of the last calls he makes is from the Lorraine Motel, and he talks to his secretary and his father, Daddy King, who was his co-pastor at Ebenezer, and he tells his secretary and his father what his sermon topic is going to be come Sunday morning. Y'all ready for this? The sermon topic was going to be entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. The I Have a Dream man was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell. He didn't condemn America to hell. He said America may go to hell. And his argument was simply this, that if we don't get serious about the racism, the poverty, and the militarism in this country, we're going to lose our democracy. We're going to lose our democracy. That Negro was right then, and he's sure enough right now. I hope you will find the book not just fascinating, but enlightening, encouraging, and empowering and inspiring. I believe in the final analysis, if you love Dr. King now, or think you love him, or think you know him, or think you respect him, when you see how he navigated the last year of his life, and the courage and the conviction and the commitment and the character that he displayed in the last year against all the odds, you're going to come up with a whole different perspective, a renewed respect for him, given the journey that he had to endure. And maybe at some point we can stop sanitizing and sterilizing who he really was, stop seeing him just as a dreamer, and come to terms with what happens to a society. And here's why the book, I believe, is not just a look back at history, but it's a cautionary tale for those of us who are alive today. Why a cautionary tale, Tavis? Because there is a huge price that societies pay when they ignore their truth tellers. And there are a whole bunch of folk today trying to tell us the truth about a variety of issues that we don't want to hear about. There are folk trying to tell us the truth about poverty, threatening this very democracy. Poverty is now a matter of national security. There are folk trying to tell us that budgets are moral documents, that our priorities are whacked, that a nation that keeps spending money the way we do on the things we spend it on is facing spiritual death. There are folk trying to tell us the truth about poverty and what it's doing to this democracy, and we don't want to hear it. There are folk trying to tell us the truth about how we're damning and degrading and damaging the environment. We don't want to hear about climate change, and we think global warming is a joke, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't want to hear it about poverty. We don't want to hear the truth about the environment. We don't want to hear the truth about these drones. I get asked everywhere I go, what would Dr. King say? And I know it's coming. And if a black person's asking me that question, I know it's a setup. They want me to go in on Obama, and they want a soundbite. I told some Negroes today, I was on black radio today, on WURD this morning, I told them Negroes today, y'all owe me an apology. And here's why you owe me an apology. You can criticize me all day long for holding Obama accountable. I've been through this for 7 years. I know what Martin felt like on a small level. I've been persona non grata in my own community for the last, Negroes loved me 8 years ago. Can't stand me for the last seven. Just because I've been trying to hold Obama accountable to the legacy of King, justice for all, service to others, a love that liberates people, racism, militarism, poverty, I'm catching hell. I'm catching hell, losing sponsors, losing money, not invited to this, not invited to that, no this, no that. Just ugly for the death threats, security with me when I travel. It's insane. Just because I'm critiquing, or as they say, criticizing the Negro president. And they can't handle that. I told these Negroes on WURD today, y'all Negroes owe me an apology. Because when you read this text and you see what Martin said about Lyndon Johnson, whoo! When you read tonight what Martin said about and to Lyndon Johnson, and we ain't even gotten to his telegrams that he would send and then release publicly. Oh, this Negro did not hold his tongue. Martin King believed, as I believe, that there's nothing, I learn this lesson every day, over and over and over, every day. It's a lifelong lesson. I learn it every day, but I believe it in all of my being. There's nothing in life that we ever have to say to another human being that we cannot find a way to say in love. You find a way to say it in love. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be received any better. Doesn't mean they're going to agree with you. And it doesn't mean that I have a monopoly on the truth. I get that. I could be wrong. I don't think so. But I could be wrong. Because there is the truth and there's the way to the truth. And I'm always on that journey trying to get to the truth. Trying to seek it and speak it and stand on it and stay with it. But I could be wrong. Have to always leave that possibility there that I could be wrong. But I think the data is going to indicate when Obama's out of office, it's already indicating this, that black people lost ground in every single leading economic category. And then we're going to have a come to Jesus meeting in black America about whether or not the price of this ticket was too high, whether or not we were too quiet in making demands. The point I'm trying to make myself to, before I take your questions, is this. How is it possible, black folk, how is it possible, progressives, liberals, how is it possible that out of deference to Barack Obama, we have become eerily silent on the war question? We ain't saying nothing. We not challenging. We not critiquing. We not protesting. We ain't talking about peace. We ain't saying nothing. Well, he got a lot on his plate. Yeah, he does. He got bad choices. Yes, he does. He's doing the best he can, maybe. But the point I'm making here is that Martin Luther King Jr. is turning in his grave. I said the other day, I wonder what that bust in the Oval Office of Dr. King must be whispering to the president late at night when he's making his war plans. What's that bust whispering to the president? So I don't care if the hate and the hell comes. One thing about writing this book, but one thing this book did for me was not that I was ever going to hold my tongue anyway, but it sure freed me. It freed me in a whole new way. Because you got to be willing to tell the truth no matter what the consequences are. And sometimes these Negroes might not catch up with you for 100 years. You just got to deal with that. But you got to speak the truth anyway that you know. And this drone program we have on steroids, Barack Obama has used more drones than George Bush did. He's killed more innocent women and children with those drones than George Bush did. He's deported more immigrants than George Bush did. And we get silent about that, and all of a sudden I'm a hater because I'm telling you the truth. These are the facts. But somebody's got to speak that truth. Everybody wants to be politically correct. And America is on its way, as Martin would say, to hell. Because not enough of us want to tell the hard truths that need to be said. Somebody's got to say it. Societies pay heavy prices when they ignore their truth telling. I'm not comparing myself to Martin. Don't leave here and say I did that. That's not my point. My point is that all of us are obligated to tell the truth that we know, me and you. Tell the truth that we know. And when we don't, our society pays a price for that. And so I hope that we can finally get to the truth of who Martin King was. And you get on, you read the book, you send me an email, I'd love to hear from you. But when you read what King said to and about Lyndon Johnson, you will see that I have come nowhere near critiquing this president. I ain't even close to what Martin said about Johnson, as you'll discover in this text. But we have to tell the truth, hold all of our leaders accountable, hold ourselves accountable for making America a nation that will one day be as good as its promise. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming out. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. So they tell, thank you. They tell me we got 10 minutes for questions, so I'll take questions or comments. You give me a short question, I promise I'll give you a short answer, and we'll see how fast we can move, and we'll sign your books. Yes, sir. I'm going to go from side to side. We'll go this way and this side, back and forth.
While we're talking about the truth, in that last year that he lived, prior to the New York text that he decided he was going to tell, his inner group, the group he relied on and talked to, and I was there, said to him, Martin, for God's sake, stay on the subject. Forget about what's happening in the war. Stay on the subject which you know, which is the subject you represent, which is the inequalities of the black people today in this country. And he stayed true to what you said. He didn't listen to that group. We were wrong. He was right. But you got to put it in the book that people had a reason for saying to him, don't do what you did.
Sure.
Because it spoils your own move. It spoils what you're really all about. We were wrong, okay? But that's part of history, and that should be in the book.
It is in the book. When you read the book, you will see it's in there. Martin understood that. They made that argument to him. He rejected that argument, as you said, and went his own way. But that argument was made. He heard it loud and clear, as I intimated earlier tonight. His staff didn't want him to do this. You're right. You were there. They didn't want him to give this speech. They said, Martin, just stick with civil rights. You know, we got more work to do down south. Don't go up north. Don't get involved in this war question. That's over there. It's not over here. That's the same reason why the black leaders got jumped over him. Because they thought, rather than focusing on the domestic agenda, Martin was off playing foreign affairs. And that was not the priority for Negroes in America at that time. Martin's thing was, I'm opposed to violence here. I'm opposed to violence there. And when he saw those little Vietnamese kids being napalmed to death, his heart couldn't take it. And he felt he had to be morally consistent on the issue of nonviolence. And that's why he did what he did. But I thank you for your comment, sir. It is in the text. Let's go to this side. We'll bounce back and forth.
On your television program, you're seldom animated and you're seldom preaching, and most of the time we don't know what your opinion is. Is it different on the stump than it is on the TV show?
you tell me. you tell me. I don't know. I try to tell the truth wherever I go. I do recognize that I've been very clear about this. I've been on public television now for 11 years, my 11th season on PBS. Thank you. And 14 or 15 years on public radio. And I understand that when I'm on public TV and public radio, it's not about my point of view. It's about me being a generous listener. And I think the greatest compliment that I ever get from people is that you listen so well. You ask such great questions. I mean, love hearing that, not because it boosts my ego, because it says to me that the audience gets what I get. That you want to have a conversation, not an interview. Interview means I got a blue card with 10 questions on it. No matter what you say, I'm going to ask my 10 questions in the order they are on this card. No matter how disconnected or disjointed the conversation might be as a result. As opposed to listen generously. And in a good conversation, the host, people think the host is leading the conversation. That ain't how it works. The guest leads the conversation. You listen generously, and when they give you an answer, they tell you where to go next based upon what they've just said. So being a great talk show host is about generous listening. You come prepared for the conversation, but you listen, and the guests will tell you where to take the conversation. So I don't get on television to offer my own political points of view, because that's not what PBS and public radio are all about. But this ain't PBS tonight. Over here.
I wanted to ask, did the King family get a chance to read your book before it was released, and what was the feedback and the feeling? I know you, in your prologue, you said you interviewed many family
sure.
and friends, and it's very controversial,
right.
A lot of feeling. Just wanted to get a sense of what...
Good question. The short answer is the book has been sent to the family. They're all personal friends of mine. I've known them and interviewed them thousands of times over the years, and I think if they were here, they'd all say Tavis is a friend of this family. They've said that for so many years in so many different ways. But I didn't talk to them about the book. You know, I didn't need their permission to write the book. Wanted to tell the story that needed to be told. Didn't want to be compromised in telling the story. And I think our friendship is going to be intact, because I hope that what they see is what I tried to do, which is to humanize their father and to try to let people know the journey that he walked and how, again, we abandoned him, and how he kept telling his truth. I hope that they won't be offended by that, but I haven't yet heard from them as to what they think of the book, even though they have been sent copies of it. So we'll see what they have to say. But I did not consult them in advance. Yes. We got some hands in the back, too. Y'all got to make your way further back. I don't want to hate on the folk in the back. I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
If I may, not a question, but a comment, if you will.
Sure.
I want to tell you this. You mentioned so many salient points. You mentioned about how during dark times, this is how you find out who your true writers mm-hmm. are, who your true people are. This is true in more ways than one. But you, the best compliment I can give you, and there are many, many I could give, is you are an amazing reflection of the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King. Because you exemplify every day of your life the same type of courage and the, excuse me, ballsiness that he showed. And it takes a lot to have a yeah. brain and a heart. And you are the gentleman that uses both, and we thank you.
I appreciate you for saying that. Thank you. Thank you. I was asked, that's very kind of you, I appreciate that. That's my dad, you guys. No, I'm just teasing. I was asked in an interview the other day if I had the chance to interview, it's a good question, Tavis, Mr. Smiley, if you had the chance to interview Dr. King, what's the one question you would ask him? I was like, ooh. And actually, it wasn't really a woo moment because I knew the answer already, because I've been thinking about this since I was 12. And the only question I would ask him, to your wonderful compliment, because my whole mission in life since I was 12, and there's a whole story about how Dr. King came into my life. Some of you know this because you read my memoir, What I Know for Sure. I was severely beaten when I was a 12-year-old kid, almost to death, as a 12-year-old kid, in the hospital for 2 weeks in traction. Didn't know if I was going to live or make it. It was an ugly story, which I won't get into tonight. But a friend of mine, a member of my church, an older man at my church, gave me a gift. It was a gift of a box of recordings. King recordings. Barry Gordy of Motown fame had the good sense to send an engineer around to follow Dr. King as he spoke. So Barry Gordy knew he gave more than one speech, and he had an engineer follow him around. And Barry eventually put a lot of these recordings out on LP. And this deacon in my church had been collecting these, and for whatever reason, God placed it on his heart, I guess, to give me this gift of all these records. And when I heard the love, I don't want to start crying tonight, but when I heard the love in his heart and the hope in his soul, his voice for me was so reassuring, because he was talking to a nation about the power of love. But he might as well have been talking to a 12-year-old boy named Tavis, because what I heard him saying to me was, Tavis, you're going to have to love your way through this. That hate and bitterness and retaliation is not an answer. You got to love your way through this. And since the age of 12, Martin at that point had long since been dead, but he brought me back to life. He literally saved my life at the age of 12. And from that moment forward, I said earlier tonight, I've been trying to do my small part to make the world safe for his legacy. So if I had a chance to meet Dr. King one time and ask him one question, I told the person who asked me this question the other day, it'd be very simple. All I want to know is, Dr. King, how am I doing? That's all I want to know. How am I doing? I would want his assessment of how he thinks I'm doing in trying to make the world safe in my small way for his legacy. So that's my question for Dr. King. How am I doing? Now, what's your question for me? Whoever's next over here.
Good evening, Sam. You spoke of the complexity of Dr. Martin Luther King character. Mm-hmm. And lots of people doesn't see the simplicity in his character. From the beginning until the end, he was a Baptist minister, uh-huh. carrying the ministry of his grandfather. As a Baptist minister, he has to do the work of the Bishop of Canterbury, if you know what I mean, without having a queen on the top of him he has to answer for. So he's pretty much, he has to speak Christ's opinion of what is happening and lead his own church. Mm-hmm. I wonder the simplicity of that.
That's a very good point. And I tell people all the time, and I think it comes through in the text, it comes through loud and clear when you read his schedule and how he got back to Atlanta every Sunday, no matter where he was, to preach at Ebenezer. We think of Dr. King as Dr. King, because he has that PhD. We think of Dr. King as a great civil rights leader. We think of Dr. King as an American icon. We think of him as a great orator. He's all that and then some. Nobel Peace Prize winner. First and foremost, Martin King was a reverend. He was a minister of the gospel. And if you were to ask him the first thing in his bio, aside from being a father and a husband, you know, it's, I'm a minister. I am a minister of the gospel. So he took that calling very seriously. So you're right. It was simple in that sense. It was just an extension of who he was. One of his greatest complaints, you'll see this in chapter 20 or 21, he is at a conference in the last days of his life speaking to a convention full of Baptist preachers. And King goes in on them and tells them that the problem with too many of us in this calling is that we're more worried about the size of our automobiles. We're more worried about the house we live in. We're more worried about what kind of love offering we get every year on Pastor's Day. He went in on them about what their calling was. He said, you have gotten too far away from the simplicity of the gospel to teach people about the power of love, to love thy neighbor as thyself. So he went in on them. So if you get to that chapter later in the book, you'll see that he understood who he was, and he understood the simplicity, quite frankly, of what he was trying to do. Now, I say simplicity because you use the word simplicity, but the truth of the matter is that for most of us, loving our enemies is the hardest thing to do. Over here, yeah. All right, they're making me go. One more question. I'm sorry. Right. I'd stay all night, but
thank you. Thank you much. I am a high school teacher, and I can't help but think about that. Martin going through the Brown versus Board of Education. Fighting separate but equal, I can assure you that schools today are even more separate, more segregated, and more unequal. Okay, mm-hmm. We have a Secretary of Education who has never taught a day in his life. Okay, and you are completely right in criticizing because. How is it that with our first African-American president, the corporate charter movement has simply run amok with no accountability? You are now in a city that doesn't have an elected school board. And I can't help but think, you know, what would King say about this whole even greater segregation?
Yeah.
Greater lack of resources.
Yeah. There's no doubt about the fact that, as I said, it's a great note to close on. If I can jump from Martin to Malcolm for just a second. Malcolm once said that education is our passport to the future. Tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today. And Malcolm was right about that. There's no doubt about the fact that Martin, first of all, because he was the recipient of a high-quality education, obviously. Morehouse and Seminary and Crozier and all that. He would certainly decry, I think, what's happening to our education system, particularly where children of color are concerned, being trapped in these dilapidated, rundown, you know, under-resourced institutions called public education. Somebody once told me, one of my guests on my TV show once said to me not long ago in a conversation that, if Benjamin Franklin, speaking of Philadelphia, if Benjamin Franklin came back today, the only thing he'd recognize would be our education system because it ain't changed much. In terms of how we go about teaching our children. So there are a lot of things that we could do better in our public education system, but I am sick and tired. I think one thing Dr. King would be annoyed by, I'm certainly annoyed by it, is the absolute assault and attack that teachers are under these days. The assault on teachers is just, and that's not to suggest that, you know, that every teacher is perfect. I say all the time, it's not that some of these kids can't learn, it's that some of these teachers can't teach. So the ones that can't teach need to get out the way. But writ large, I'm just tired of living in a society where we think that the first line of defense is to demonize and to bastardize those who choose to go in the classroom. They're not there to get wealthy. Certainly not. They do it because they love the opportunity to teach these kids, most of them. And so I think we've gotten to a point now where we just demonize teachers because it's the easy thing. It's a layup. It's the easy thing to do. But certainly, I have many critiques, and we're out of time, so I won't go into it tonight. But there are many critiques of education in this country. And even in the Obama era, I said to Arne Duncan one time, you know, they have touted this program Race to the Top. And I got all kinds of issues with it if I had time to get into that tonight. But I said to him one day in a conversation, Mr. Secretary, education is not a race. It ought to be a right. It's not a race. It's a right. And when you got folk who have to compete for resources versus every child in this country having access to an equal, high-quality education, a race is a different thing. My child, your child, should not have to race to get a good education. It ought to be his birthright as a U.S. citizen, that he has access to a good, high-quality education. Now, that doesn't mean that we can determine the outcomes, but we ought to have every child start at the same starting line. So that's why I say an equal, high-quality education. What do you mean by that, Tavis? Don't matter to me. Show me the best schools in this country. And whatever they have, give it to everybody else. Give it to everybody else. Thank you for coming out. I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.